Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Today's guest is Ray Tsang, a developer advocate on the Google Cloud Platform. And you know what? I was a little skeptical about having this interview with him, and for very good reasons, mind you. Ray is someone with whom I've had the privilege of speaking more often than I do perhaps many of the other guests that I have on this podcast. Indeed, a big reason I started this podcast was to give voice to those with whom I don't often have the opportunity to just hang out, you know? But Ray, he's in my line of work. We bump into each other everywhere, right? I mean, all around the planet, all around the globe. We spend our time on the circuit talking to people, right? So we've even spent a week in Chicago hacking on code together. As he's nominally based in the U.S., as I am nominally based in the U.S., we even have a more ready we're more readily able to talk on Twitter too. So I was unsure of what sort of conversation we could have, the two of us, two talking head types, that we haven't already had. And you know what? It turns out we have tons of things about which we can talk. And this is one of those interviews that I recorded a while back in the summer of 2018, and that we're just now getting out there. And in the interim months since we recorded this, I've had the privilege of visiting Taipei in Taiwan, which is Ray's old stomping ground. And there I fattened myself on the amazing food. And now, as I'm producing this episode for your consumption, I'm simultaneously both eager to bump into my old friend Ray again and to eat. I'm starving. I mean, the food, just thinking about the amazing food is a little overwhelming. So, I hope that you enjoy this episode. Ray works at Google. I, of course, at Pivotal. We're friends. Our companies are friends. And so this is just a friendly episode. There's just a whole bunch of stuff that I suppose I took for granted going into the interview, but then you talk about it and you realize there's a lot of interesting stuff there that we should do a better job of advertising. So we're going to cover a whole bunch of things today. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about our shared love of Spring and clouds, all sorts of clouds, really. And then we talk about, of course, his Twitter handle, which has its own backstory, innumerable many other cool things. So with that, let's get to it. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, good. How are you?
Good, man. Thanks for joining us today. I know you're a busy human being, and glad we could find time on your calendar to do this. Thanks for hanging out.
Absolutely. It's more like the other way around.
Well,
thank you for having the time.
I'm super glad we can make it work. What time is it in whatever time zone you're in right now?
I'm in New York this week or today. And it's 7 p.m.
Oh, okay. So I'm just keeping you from dinner. Nothing important. There's there's food. No. There's always food. You're in New York City. You can eat, you know, all day, all night.
That's right.
Have something. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So actually, where do you work?
Where?
Yeah.
So I work at Google for Google Cloud Platform, and I'm based in New York.
Now, when you mentioned New York, I should ask this: why are you in New York? Or have you always been in New York? I think I remember you being from Southern California, like myself.
Yeah. So I grew up, until 12, I was in Taiwan, and then my family moved to California, to Orange County area, and then for the job at Google, I moved to New York. I was given a choice between San Francisco and New York, and I thought maybe it's time for me to check out another state, and here I am.
That's a good decision. I love New York. New York's don't ever move, because I visit New York almost as much as I visit California. So it's good to have friends in New York, you know.
Yeah. But it is cold here. It gets cold. My first year here was a little miserable because I wasn't used to the cold here.
Mean something below 72 degrees?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, in SoCal, everything is like above 60 probably. Every day is sunny. Yeah.
T-shirt weather all year. It's perfect.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But not the case here.
No. Oh, well. Okay. I love New York, and my partner Tammy, her sister came in to visit her, and I sent them to New York. I said, you know, I sent them to New York, and I said, you should go see the city and go take it in. And you know, it's kind of an impromptu thing. And I got them tickets for the weekend. And little did I know, that was January this year when they had that crazy, like, record-setting blizzard that where it was colder than usual, even for winter in New York. So they got there. They got there and they sent me these photos of what looked like the tundra, you know, streets of New York that would otherwise be, you know, packed, just empty ghost towns.
Yeah.
So they were not impressed. They were not impressed with me or that city for that particular day, you know.
I remember those days when the first year I came here, the winter was the one of the coldest years, I think. Yeah. That's where, like, it was, there were a lot of news about polar vortex, I suppose. I was walking home one day, it was 1 Fahrenheit, and I was not very happy.
Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my. Fahrenheit. -17 in Celsius, which I think the technical term is cold.
Yeah.
Very, very cold. Well, okay. I'm glad you survived. And there's, you know, the nice thing about it, our world is that there's always a plane out somewhere, you know?
So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay, good. So you're at Google and you moved there. You moved to New York for this Google. Is that some sort of ad company? I mean, what do they do?
Yeah. So funny enough, so Google has many things, right? And most people know it by search and Gmail and YouTube and many other things. When I first moved here for this job, actually, I started off only for developer relations. That's the only reason why I joined, because I love to work with the developer. I was, just learning about a little bit about, you know, writing blogs and public speaking, and I thought I really enjoyed doing it. So when they said, "Hey, you know, we may have an opportunity here in developer relations," and I said, "Oh, okay, well, let's give it a try." And my first year at Google was not with cloud, actually. That's my current role, which is a developer advocate for cloud platform. But when I first joined, it was actually with AdWords. So it was developer relations for AdWords API. Yeah. So it was very different than what cloud is. Yeah.
Sounds like they're both profitable. So either way, interesting place to be. Where did you come from? Where were you before? I think I remember you being at one of those other companies that I may have heard of.
Yeah. So prior to Google, I was at Red Hat, actually. Uh-huh. Yeah. With a lot of JBoss stuff.
Love the JBoss stuff. Good stuff there.
Yep. And I was a solution architect at JBoss at the time.
All right. So you cut your teeth in doing enterprise stuff, which is don't let anybody tell you otherwise. That's difficult.
It is pretty difficult, absolutely. Especially with financial services and all that. It gets very interesting to see the level of, you know, concerns, you know, everybody has, and it's difficult for sure.
You find a weird mix of configurations and you know, combinations of things that you just think could never possibly work together in enterprises. You know, these are it's the opposite of a predictable, you know, the variety is terrifying sometimes.
Yeah. And I was on this team. I remember we actually do a lot of proof of concepts.
Yeah.
So we actually go into the companies and we create, we learn what the issues are. We see what kind of architecture or solutions can help.
Yeah.
And then we actually build it on the spot for the next day or two with the real systems and potentially test data that we're able to access and see how the solution works. And, it's quite challenging, actually.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And plus, Red Hat is a nobody would ever say that they are a one trick pony, right? They have 1,000 different things that they do that people care about and depend on and use. So to be able to talk about all of Red Hat is a pretty impressive, man. I think by that measure, Google's breadth doesn't seem quite as expansive, does it?
Yeah, I think there are different things. And like, for example, Red Hat, of course, I don't really get into the operating system side of things. So all of that, is magic. just turn the machine on. If I get a show prompt, I'm happy.
Yeah, me too. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and now I think you and I are both at sort of cloud companies. We care about a different operating system, a slightly higher level operating system, you know?
Right.
So now you're at Google, and you and I, we've bumped into each other, once or twice over the last few years.
Yeah.
What's the latest and greatest on your side? What are you talking about to developers these days?
So my focus area had always been what I am, what I almost kind of grew up with, which is mostly enterprise architecture, service-oriented architecture, if I were allowed to say that word.
Sure.
Right. But now it's kind of transformed into, this another incarnation of it, which is microservices. So my focus area had always been around the architecture and how that relates to, say, Java developer, because that's the language of my choice for many, many years now. So some of the new things that I found that's really interesting and has a really good potential are things like, Kubernetes is one, and Istio is another, which is a service mesh concept that may help for those people who are looking into using microservices architecture to solve their problems.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, good. Yeah, that's awesome. The Istio is becoming a very interesting. The whole discussion around service meshes, including Istio and Envoy and Linkerd, all these different service mesh technologies in the last 5 years. That's become kind of interesting, and I see it coincident with the rise of microservices as people just start to scale out. They look for ways to do things that. You could do in a single place if you wanted to, but it's easier to have it sort of co-located with the deployed service, thanks to an agent, a sidecar kind of thing. And that service mesh approach, that really works nicely, right? I mean, we see some people moving to it, for example, to support tracing, right? And so, you have tracing in the platform, obviously. If you want, you can use GCP and get that at the platform level, or you can use Cloud Foundry and get it at the platform level. But having this thing that you can deploy and have it say, okay, I'm gonna extricate the tracing responsibility from your code base and from your application logic, and you still get the same benefits for at least insofar as you have your application is a black box, and insofar as you're okay with just seeing the ingress and egress for the application. Having the service mesh do that is a very, very convenient,
Yeah, it's convenient. But like, I think in my mind, the Netflix OSS stuff is really good as well. Mm-hmm. And just that it's really, I think the whole concept with service mesh and what, the Netflix OSS stack is trying to solve, they are all very similar. They are all of these cross-cutting concerns. Mm-hmm. It's really just where do you want to solve it? Do you want to solve it in the code, or do you want to solve it in another layer? But, the code, the logic doesn't just magically disappear. It's either your code or somebody else's code, right?
Well, I think it's a nice, they complement each other, I think, right? I mean, there's certain things where your application is going to be better situated, and situations where the mesh will be better situated. And I just like that. I'm all about picking the right tool for the job. And
exactly.
So for example, if you have a circuit breaker in a mesh, you can do certain generic things, but if you want to have some sort of fallback behavior, if you want to handle the exception in some way meaningful in your code, then, so having the ability to say, okay, for the 80% case, here's the mesh, I'll do that kind of thing. I'll redirect or just return a status code or whatever. But for this particular case, I want to handle it a particular use case, particular way.
Absolutely. And even for trace, as much the service mesh can do, applications will still have to propagate the trace headers.
Right.
Otherwise, the separate requests cannot be correlated together without the trace headers. And for that, again, something like Spring Cloud Sleuth, which is something I really enjoy using, it can propagate the headers for you when you use a REST template and all that. Just things just happens automatically.
Yeah.
You still need that, right?
Like
that code doesn't just go away.
But having, having that there, but then having it, and also for component boundaries in the same process, in the same Java process, that right. trace information is not visible to the service mesh, right? So that having that, having the code aware of it, but having the mesh be able to propagate from node to node, from, you know, across the different nodes, that's really cool. And speaking of, you mentioned Spring Cloud Sleuth, which of course is our the Spring Cloud distributed tracing abstraction. But and normally when we talk to people about Sleuth, the first thing I reach for usually in a non-Google context is Zipkin. But you are privileged enough, you're lucky enough, and users of Google Cloud are lucky enough to have access to Stacktrace, right? So that's you worked on the you and Google worked on the Stacktrace integration there for Sleuth, didn't you?
Yeah, Stackdriver Trace. And so actually, this is one of the integrations that we built as part of the Spring Cloud GCP project, right. which actually has a bunch of different type of integrations for Spring Boot applications. We provide the starters that gets you, you know, connected with some of these managed services so that you don't really have to change the code on your side. So I actually built the integration part with Spring Cloud Sleuth that will actually propagate the trace to Stackdriver Trace behind the scenes. So you don't have to run, for example, your own Zipkin instance. If you don't want to manage it, you can just propagate the trace information to our managed services. Then you can use our UI and tooling to figure out, you know, and diagnose what is wrong with the system.
Nice. And and what happened? Whatever happened to the proxy that you and I worked on a little while ago?
Oh yeah, the proxy is still there. Actually, the proxy is still useful. So if you don't want to propagate trace directly to Stackdriver, if you have other applications that still need to use Zipkin, then they can continue to send the Zipkin traces to the Zipkin server that is known as the Zipkin proxy, and that can actually then forward the trace data to Stackdriver Trace behind the scenes. So it has no storage; it simply proxies the request and forwards over. In fact, that proxy now is part of the Zipkin project. You can actually find it under Zipkin-GCP. And I know Adrian Koh has been, you know, spending some time on that as well. It's just part of the ecosystem.
He's doesn't sleep, you know. I'm convinced of it. He just keeps coding until things are better.
He's so good because, you know, we had a roadmap on, I drafted like a little roadmap on how, you know, how we can get that into Zipkin project as a whole. And a few other things that we needed, which would be, you know, like a Zipkin sender. So even if you don't use any of the Spring Cloud GCP stuff, but you are using Zipkin, you can use the Zipkin sender component. So rather than sending it to, you know, to say Kafka or to Zipkin server directly, the sender, you can just drop in and they can actually send it to Stackdriver Trace. So all the code I wrote for Spring Cloud Sleuth eventually got deprecated and removed, and and now we're basically just using, you know, Brave, you know, whatever Spring Cloud Sleuth 2 is using, which is Brave,
right?
And we just auto configure the Zipkin sender behind the scenes. So everything that I wrote actually got deprecated and thrown away.
Well, it's a good problem to have, I suppose. Progress by any other name.
Yeah, which is nice because then my net output will be zero in this case.
People will, I know, and people are, you know, the audience will know that you helped get us there, right?
Yeah, I think I think that really happened after you and I met actually in Chicago that 1 week, which was super awesome.
That was fun.
Yeah.
And we chose Chicago because either you could come to me in San Francisco or I could go to you in New York, and we'd both been to both cities enough times and we just figured, somewhere else. So we paired in Chicago. That was actually a cold Chicago week. That was a fun one.
Yeah. Well, I remember we also work on the some integration for Spanner.
Yes.
So I was doing a POC on, well, how do we use Spring data with Spanner, you know, to store data. And I remember you said, well, Ray, be careful. It depends on how deep you want to go.
Yeah.
How deep of a hole you want to dig for yourself.
A year later, and have you found the hole yet?
Yeah, we actually have Spinner support in Spring Cloud GCP now.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. I'm super impressed, all that. You've got Spanner. You've got Google Cloud SQL. I don't even know what that one is. I know PubSub, of course. I know the config stuff, the storage. What is SQL? Does that point to? What does that point to?
So Cloud SQL can be either a managed MySQL service or a managed PostgreSQL service. You can use either one of them. But it's just that we'll provision and manage the SQL instances for you. You can choose to be highly available, and we'll do the replication and the backup and such and such. But like all cloud services, is one of those things where you can either use a command line, an API, or use the console to just say, I need an instance of this size with HA in this zone or this region, and we'll provision everything
for you. That's super cool. And then you and I, in that week, I remember, do you remember writing Go code?
Oh my goodness. Yes. Yeah. Trying to, just for the record, I don't write Go code.
Me either.
Josh, I don't know if you wrote Go code before.
I have, and it was fun, but this was a little deeper than I had gone before. So I think we did pretty well.
Yeah. So
where'd that end up?
Yeah, so I remember we wrote stuff with the service broker,
right?
That will be it's the service broker in PCF, so that you can provision additional cloud services. There were a few service brokers that you can provision already,
right?
And we just added two more functionalities that we thought would be awesome to show. One of them was Trace,
the driver, the proxy,
and the other one was Debugger.
Right. Oh, that one was cool. Tell the audience about the Debugger. That one was an amazing demo. I wish people could see this. If you haven't seen it, Google what he's about to describe. Go YouTube.
Yeah. So it's called the Stardriver Debugger, I think. And basically, what we can do is in your app, you can attach an agent, and with the right credentials, this agent will then communicate, with Google Cloud Service, where you can either use the web console or an IntelliJ IDE. You can actually put in what we call a snapshot point into your running code. And when somebody goes through that line of code, rather than blocking and stopping the world, we can actually take a snapshot of the code stack in almost real time. And so you can actually see what variable values are. You can drill down into the POJOs, into the different nested POJOs underneath. You can actually see what's actually being passed through. And you can see the code stack.
Yeah.
What is even more awesome is that I think it was after when we met, they had something called the log point. But what that is you can actually, again, in the console or in the console, you can add a new log message live to your application.
That's so cool.
That is cool. So like if you're missing a log, rather than having to go back and
redeploy.
Go through the redeploy and check out the right code, redeploy and all that, you can just click a button and say, I need a new log message here. This is what it should be saying with this variable output. And it will be printed.
It's just sorcery. It's just devil magic. It's amazing. I can't believe some of the things the wizards at Google are doing. To make every developer happy. I mean, that's a developer's lives feature, that's that they care about developers there.
Oh, absolutely. And that reminds me of the story where after we're all done with that, right, after we created the service broker, you actually connected me with Ben Hill.
Oh yeah,
right.
I love Ben.
Yeah. And we said, hey, can we actually add this agent automatically into the PCF build pack?
Right.
And like a couple of weeks later, it was done. And
So for reference to the audience here, Ben Hale is the lead of the Java experience on Cloud Foundry. PCF is Pivotal Cloud Foundry. A service broker is an API. It's an SPI that the platform, be it Kubernetes or Cloud Foundry, can then call to then have the service broker provision infrastructure of some sort, a database, a message queue, whatever. It's a generic SPI that acts as a driver, if you will, for these middleware constructs that you might need, machinery that you might need somewhere. And then a build pack is a file system with a certain ordered structure that the platform like Cloud Foundry or Heroku expects to behave in a certain way. And it has scripts in a certain set of locations. And assuming you call those scripts in those in the right order in the lifecycle of the build pack, it'll result in a file system that can then be baked into a container that can then be deployed onto the platform like Heroku or Cloud Foundry. And so the result is we have a Java build pack. You give it a .jar or a .war or something, and it'll create a file system in an environment that can run that and then deploy it on the platform for you. So you're saying we talked to Ben, who leads the Java build pack for, he leads that experience. And you asked him, hey, can we do this thing that we thought would be crazy and impossible? And he just sort of shrugged. And as soon as we knew it, it was already done.
So basically, you can deploy the jar into CF, and if you have the debugger service broker enabled and configured, it detects that this is in the environment, and the build pack will just add this agent automatically, configure it with the right credentials, and now you can debug your app live.
That is so cool.
Yeah, as we're doing this, actually, this is the coolest part, because Ben had to test it out.
Yeah.
And so when he was testing it, he had this app running with the debugger agent running on his laptop. And he was asking me, does it actually work? He couldn't tell. And so I went to the console, and then I added a snapshot. I'm like, hey, Ben, why don't you trigger a URL? And I was able to see the snapshot that was being taken.
And you're not in the same room. You're not even necessarily on the same side of the continent.
Yeah. Exactly.
I just love that stuff. Love it. How does that synchronize stay? Is that spanner behind the scenes? I mean, are you using that to propagate context from the debugger to the snapshot?
I'm not quite sure. It's definitely somewhere in the cloud, but I don't know exactly where they're actually storing the data.
Because I remember it was near instantaneous, right? I mean, that was seems like a spanner use case. I don't know, whatever. It was cool. It was really, really cool. And compare that to the normal process of taking a snapshot and then opening up the profiler and throwing that in there or something like that. It was just, getting that feedback, that feedback loop shortened so nicely. So that's really cool.
Definitely fun.
Yeah, that is, and that's all open source. So you're working on open source. You're like me. You find gaps and you try and fill them, right? So it's not our, at least for me, it's not my main job, but it is definitely a big part of the job, right? I find these, if there are gaps, I try and talk to people or I send pull requests filled with bugs in my case, of course, just endless amount of bugs, but nonetheless, pull requests and small changes make a big difference over time, right?
Yeah.
And the result is all these little changes, all these little footprints. And I think you and I are lucky because I can't imagine being in our position, let's say 20 years ago, before I can't even imagine what open, I was there. I certainly participated. I certainly did it, but I look back and I don't remember I don't know how we did anything, prior to GitHub, right? Prior to this very socialized sort of, experience. And that's really apropos given today's news, that other enterprise company out there, bought, GitHub today. What do you think of that?
No comment. I think we'll see what happens. I'm pretty sure it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, so. I'm hopeful.
Awesome, yeah.
I like GitHub, and Microsoft seem to be, they seem to be in it to win it. So, pretty good. Does Google have a presence on GitHub? I know you do, but where does Google put their open source?
Yeah, so there are actually a number of repositories out there for Google. There's /Google, and then there's /Google Cloud Platform. And then we have other open source projects like Istio and Kubernetes, where we did open source it, and gRPC. They all have their own repository. Open Census, which is another one that just came out recently for instrumentation and tracing. So they are, they don't always go into the Google or Google Cloud organization on GitHub, but they're out there. Yeah.
Where's Android these days?
I don't know. I actually don't use Android, so I'm a iPhone user myself.
To code. Oh, look at that. You go to the Android website. It takes you to the Android open source. It's on Google Source. I'm not sure what I'm looking at, but I'm going to run away from this. It's that ability to. And so you mentioned Spring Cloud GCP. That's actually a project that is being it's hosted and managed in the Spring projects, right? It's a part of the Spring projects. Right now, it looks like it's at version 1.0M3, and it's going to be included in Spring Cloud Finchley. Is that right, or is that the next one?
No. So it's made to work with Finchly, but the Finchly release train is going definitely faster than what we can, go GA with.
Sure.
So Finchly is going to go GA first, and then we're going to be based on the Finchly GA. Mm-hmm. We're very close following behind it right now. And hopefully we'll have a RC version pretty soon. And then we will have the GA, hopefully, this year.
Yeah. And hopefully that gets picked up in the Spring Cloud release train after GA.
Yeah.
After GA.
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. I love seeing all these little, I live for the checkboxes. And so to be able to have all these things supported on the initializer, to me, that's a big deal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What do we have here? We've got certain checkboxes already for Spring Cloud GCP.
Yeah.
But we got messaging, we got storage, and the generic base platform support. That's already on the initializer. Are those using, so that's all using the milestones right now?
Yeah, I think so. It's either eventually the latest milestone or the RC. No, I think it's probably the one of the milestones at this very moment. Yeah.
So walk me through it. Walk our audience through it. Basically, if you go to start.spring.io, you scroll down, you look at the Spring Cloud GCP column and you add GCP messaging. What am I going to need to be able to use that? I know that I'm going to need a Google Cloud account, right? Is that hard to get?
No. So Google Cloud account, you can just create one, and there's a $300 free trial actually. While we're at it, but no, you can. Yeah, you can. You can. If you don't have one already, you can sign up for the free trial. After that, you need to create a project. So everything in Google Cloud is organized in projects. A single project may have a number of different resources. Like a project will have its own network, its own resources, like virtual machines will go into the project as well. And you can have many, many different projects, right? So you need to create a project, and that's where you can create some of the resources for you to use. So for example, if you want to use messaging for PubSub, you can just go into the project and go to PubSub, and you can create a topic, for example. So unlike other messaging systems where you do need to either wait for things to provision the VM or to configure the storage yourself, right? For PubSub, it literally is a managed service where you just click, I need a topic, done in like when a page like succeeds, you're done.
Right.
And you can start sending topics, messages to it.
Nice.
In Spring Code, you can send a message a number of different ways. If you like to use Spring integration, you can use Spring integration semantics. So like gateways. Is it gateways? I think.
Yeah. Well, we have channels and gateways in Spring integration, and we have outbound adapters, inbound adapters, and gateways. The outbound and inbound are unidirectional. The gateways are bidirectional.
Yeah, so we can actually just tie into those existing ecosystem, and then we have the activator. Is that right? That can bind the channels to the actual PubSub topics, for example. If you need to receive a message, a topic, you can create a subscription against a topic. Once you have the subscription, then you can subscribe to it. Then you are going to be able to get messages delivered to your application. And again, you can use Spring integration to do that, or you can just use a PubSub template, some kind of object that you can just inject, and you get access to a lot of the common PubSub operations.
And if you're a Spring user, you've probably used a template at some point, right? I mean, that's a well-tried pattern. We hope. So that's very cool. I mean, that's already there. That's marching along swimmingly. And what do you think? Do you think there's going to be new things supported? And once we get to GA on the Spring Cloud GCP, what do you think the next frontier is? What do you want to support more ambitiously? Or
so let's see here. So right now we can store blobs into cloud storage with a Spring resource, right? Mm-hmm. We have Spring data for Spanner, which is really awesome. Mm-hmm. So we can use some basic ORM mapping. You can store data into Spanner, which, by the way, is a globally distributed, strongly consistent relational database. So
that's awesome.
All of those three words don't usually go into the same sentence, right?
Right.
But you can do that. Configuration, we can store config. But I think some people have been asking for Spring Data for Data Store. Mm-hmm. So Data Store is another NoSQL database that we have. So that's different from Cloud SQL. It's different from Spanner. Data Store is not relational, but it is more traditional, like a document database. So people have been asking to use Data Store with Spring Data. So I know that's something that is being looked at and worked on as well.
Nice.
So I think that would be pretty awesome. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really up to, you know, also the community to let us know what they want and what would be useful for them. And, you know, we discovered a lot of these things through working with you, Josh, actually.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Like, hey, it would be nice to show Spanner. Oh, but I don't want to use those APIs directly. Right. And then we thought about, okay, how can we make this work in an idiomatic way for Spring?
Right.
And that's why we started the POC. Yeah.
It's turned out really, really nicely. I'm very impressed with where this is all going. I'm all about getting to production, and production in the case of Google Cloud is a really nice, it's a nice place to be. It's just, there's a lot of really interesting things that are compelling for people who are building applications. So I think, I'm all about getting there as quickly as possible. I love Cloud Foundry for that reason, because it gives me the, you know, here's a jar, just run it. But then when you think about what draws you to a particular platform, sort of interesting, innovative services, interesting, innovative resources, things like Spanner, right? Those draws are very compelling. And to have that work in a nice, seamless way for Spring developers, and to work seamlessly for Cloud Foundry users, right? You can run Cloud Foundry on Google Cloud, and it's just a backing service. You just use the service broker and just bind to it, just like anything else you would. Really compelling, you know?
You can also run your stuff off of the cloud, and just with the right credential, you can, if you want, you can connect to the cloud services from on-prem as well.
Oh, sure. I mean, you can, great for development too, because I don't want to have to deploy Cloud Foundry. I don't want to have to deploy to Cloud Foundry on GCP just to be able to see, just to see one thing work. And that's, by the way, that I guess that bears clarification. Earlier we talked about debugging. You're not proposing we debug during development all the time on Google Cloud. It's only if we're trying to figure out something wrong in integration environment or something greater than your local machine, right? Once you move on your local machine.
Yeah, but actually recently I was working on this pet clinic thing.
Oh, that old thing.
So I have this Spring Pet Clinic project that I adopted and switched out the underlying things with Spring Cloud GCP project with Spring Cloud Spanner.
Nice.
So I have an entire pet clinic running on this type of system, right? That's pretty cool. But, it is a microservices architecture thing, so I had to try and test different things out. And I do just deploy directly into my Kubernetes cluster. And once I deployed it, because I have so many services, I don't really want to test individual ones out. So I deploy everything into Kubernetes.
Right.
And then I figure out, okay, it's not working. What do I do? I actually ended up using a lot of these things with the debugger, the log point, to see the trace, to see where things broke.
Oh, for the integration,
Yeah, it actually did help me. It was good. Yeah, but for the most part, though, I think that these are just tools that's really useful for production systems.
Right. I think people are going to develop things in isolation on their local machine, We've got Google Cloud, we've got gRPC, we've got Spring in the mix, we've got Cloud Foundry, Kubernetes, Istio, all this good stuff. What do you think is missing? Where are we? Where are the Spring and Google communities just missing out? What can we do better?
I was thinking through that. I have started with a series of different presentations, right? So when I look at what I have presented so far, there are the basics with Docker and creating containers, and then there's deploying containers into a cluster, orchestrating it with, say, Kubernetes, and then there's the gRPC, potentially for inter-service communication, and then there's the Istio potentially to help with a service mesh to help you with cross-cutting concerns. So I think, to be honest, I think computing-wise, the technology is pretty complete. Then I look at, what am I missing? in all of these contexts. And I think there are maybe a couple of things, and security is probably one thing that people haven't, you know, paid a lot of attention to in this right. entire context, right? So I think in my mind, security and best practices are really important. And what's next? As people are adopting some of these architecture, starting to use these tooling, and hopefully have a really good set of platform to help them observe the system, then, you know, what is really missing would really be security in that case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's it's one of the things you shouldn't leave to the end. And these days, why would you want to leave it to the end? It's not even that difficult to get it right, especially when the platform manages 90% of it. Usually it's just a you know, a toggle here, a checkbox there, some configuration. That's true. Definitely don't want to leave that out. Are there things that users that you interact with are struggling with that they, for example, Spring. Spring isn't, you know, it doesn't do everything, obviously, yeah. right? Yeah. And so the ecosystem fleshes out a lot of the gaps. One thing that you worked on, which I think is quite interesting, was the gRPC, you know, Spring support there. Is that project still out there? What's happening with that?
It's still there, but I haven't really updated for a while. But I think there are some very interesting community projects that's happening. So, for example, Salesforce, they actually have contributed to some gRPC projects where two things. Number one is that they are able to generate gRPC stubs. So these are just client-side code or server-side stubs that uses Java 8 with the features and completable features and stuff like that. And they wrote this generator in Java that uses a really nice templating system in Java as well. So you don't have to deal with the C++ code that nice. Missed out the gRPC use. Yeah. So that's number one. However, what is more impressive is that they built on this foundation, they actually built a reactive gRPC plugin where you can generate and write RxJava 2 code that can talk to another server via gRPC, and you can handle the call with RxJava 2 call. So it kind of abstracts away some of these like gRPC level code, and you just deal with RxJava. And they also support Reactor as well. So
right. Oh, that's awesome. And Reactor, of course, is the in that RxJava 2 supports directed stream specification. You can interoperate with anything that supports publishers and subscribers and the like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is that gRPC actually supports back pressure handling end-to-end on both sides. So you can have unidirectional streaming, or you can have bidirectional streaming, and it can actually handle back pressure end-to-end at the protocol level. So that, you know, if you're using RxJava or Reactor where you do need back pressure support over the wire, this is one of the ways to do it.
That's amazing. And so does your integration for Spring and gRPC support that, or is that a separate effort so far?
So my project is a little stale, but the same people from Salesforce, he actually also created the Spring boot starter for gRPC. So I think that's probably the latest ones that works really well. Nice. So rather than using my project, I think that the Salesforce one is going to be pretty decent. And there are a number of other ones out there too, but this one happens to integrate with the rest of their ecosystem. Yeah.
Oh, that's super cool. So I
check it out.
You see people using gRPC and high performance protocols independent of regular HTTP, you know, and for some people HTTP/2 is maybe enough, but gRPC I think is getting a lot of traction for a certain class of user, and that's for obvious reasons. You know, you get more control in certain cases, especially when it comes to being able to throttle production or consumption of data with back pressure. That's awesome.
Yeah. And another really interesting one is that gHipster. A friend from the community, he also wrote a gHipster gRPC generator. So you can actually generate gHipster services that uses gRPC as the communication protocol.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. JHipster, of course, is a code generator for Angular and Spring Boot applications. I think it's really Spring Boot applications and there's some Angular, you know, which is but there's a whole list of different things you can opt in to include in this code generated Spring Boot thing, right?
Right.
Including as you say.
Yeah.
gRPC. So that's really good. That seems very promising. So this seems like a good situation. This is all thanks to people out in the industry building on, you know, standing on this. We get to stand on the shoulders of giants here. I feel like that's a really, really interesting opportunity for people using Spring from the perspective of Google Cloud and so on. And on Google Cloud, you have the what's your container, what's your Kubernetes thing, GKE?
It's called the Kubernetes engine, GKE.
Right. Yeah, GKE. So GKE, of course, is I think an interesting place to run Kubernetes as well. That seems to be, I really quite like that. That's a very, you know, easy to spin up environment for Kubernetes, and I use it for Project Riff. Project Riff, of course, is the function as a service platform. So, you know, we have PKS, Pivotal Kubernetes Service, or PK. It's our Kubernetes implementation. But for my little demos, I use GKE and Project Riff, and that's really interesting. I mean, it's just been, you know, super easy to get started with. So that's interesting. And then, of course, you get from there and you look at the Spring Cloud Kubernetes efforts. Are you involved in any of those?
I have seen it, but I'm not involved there. But if I recall correctly, they just recently made it work with Spring Boot 2, right?
Right. That's a recent upgrade.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. That's interesting as well. There's been a number of these. And so actually I get confused. I should have perhaps done some research before we did this, but I the Spring Cloud Kubernetes thing is, I mean, didn't Red Hat have one at some point? I mean, there's a lot of different interesting organizations rallying around Spring Cloud. So you've got Google Cloud doing a Spring Cloud integration. You've got Red Hat and Fabricate. I'm not sure if that's what with our friend James Strachan having left. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where that stands. I'm sure it's probably making a lot of progress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Spring. So like for JHipster, we also thought about, so for the context, I also happened to have written the first version of the JHipster generator for Kubernetes. So if you wrote JHipster, you know, if you generated your Spring Boot app with JHipster with microservices, you can also deploy them into Kubernetes if you want to by using that generator.
Right.
And we are thinking of potentially adding another option there to use Spring Cloud Kubernetes eventually. But we tried it out a couple conferences ago with but then it was only working for Spring Boot 1, but JHipster was producing Spring Boot 2 code, so that didn't really match up. Yeah.
Right,
but now it should just work.
It's a good problem to have. These things are moving so fast that we have to wait. We have to sit on the sidelines and wait for everything to catch up. You know.
Yeah.
What is the next conference you're going to be at? I know I got you in your last free days at home today.
Yeah. So I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm gonna be in Geekout.
Yeah.
And then GBCN, it's gonna be my first time there. So.
Oh my goodness, that's a good one.
Yeah, I have not been there before, so I'm looking forward to it.
I've heard good things. I've never been to. That's the one in Spain, right? Yeah.
And JNation, and and then JHipsterConf, actually.
I'll see you there.
I'll see you there. Absolutely.
Okay. That's gonna be a good one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's awesome. So I appreciate all that you're doing, my friend. You're a great asset to the ecosystem and a great partner for the Spring ecosystem and Pivotal at large. And, you know, as always, I love our conversations. You and I got to sit and chat for, we got to code in Morocco. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun. was that the first time I actually got to know you a little bit better? Like, that's where we actually first, you know, meet and then sit down and, you know, code a little bit, right?
Right, exactly. And so that was, I think that was a really interesting, yeah. That was, you know, that was good. For me, that was a really fun evening because we were both sort of sat in the hotel and there we are in beautiful Morocco. And we were just like, no, that's code. Yeah. we had so much to talk about. So I knew right then and there, this is a human being I want to hang out with. And of course, for you, it's, you know, in this relationship, I feel like I got the better of the deal. It's been fun, man. We'll have to do this again sooner rather than later. I'm going to encourage all of our listeners to go to where should they go to find more about you, to talk to you, et cetera.
So to find me, I think easiest way is on Twitter at Satanism. I just recently created a little website so that people can find me a little easier. It's satanism.me. So satanism.me.
How do you spell Saturnism?
S-A-T-U-R. N-I-S-M.
And what does Saturnism refer to?
What does it mean?
Yeah.
Funny. Somebody asked me this question today at a customer meeting, actually. And so there's a story behind it. Have you ever used IRC?
Yeah.
Undernet, EFNet, or, you know, some of these old school things. Yeah. So on IRC, you can pick and choose any nickname you want without registering, right? Back then, you just sign on and then you get the name. So yes. I used to be Saturn. And there are other people who want to be Saturn as well.
Sure.
And we started to fight with each other. And the way that you fight on IRC back then is you just find the IP address of this other person and then you knock them offline.
Yeah.
So I got tired of that and said, I'm like, all right, I'm not going to do this anymore. I give up. I'm just going to change my name. So I changed it to Saturnism. Right, Saturnism. And I didn't think too much about it until recently, you know, when I give talks, I actually look up, like, what does that actually mean? It's actually a real word. I didn't choose it because of the meaning, but it's actually a real word.
And do I want to know what it means?
It actually means lead poisoned for some reason.
Oh, that's so cool.
Well, I didn't choose it because of it.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay. Wow. I'm using your company's website. What's it called? Google.
Yeah.
To find the definition here. Yeah. Archaic term for lead poisoning, mid 19th century from Saturn in the obsolete alchemical sense of lead plus ism. Oh, that's so nifty.
Yeah.
Wait, random win. That's like finding money in the street. That's just really cool.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Like whenever I say this, people are like, what? You're lead poisoned? I'm like, no, but like, that's not why you chose it.
Well, I mean, that's true.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. It's not exactly what you want, but you know,
it's
pretty cool.
Yeah.
You could always rebrand, I guess. I mean, I kind of thought about rebranding every now and then.
Really?
Well, I mean, IRC is not, Twitter is not IRC, unfortunately. So, but I always thought like, what would I use? And then do you remember James Ward? He did that. Yeah. He was a what is it? RIA, Rich Internet Application, whatever, Cowboy or something like that.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, he was like for years, for a long, long, long time, many years, 5 years, 6 years, whatever. And then, of course, you know, he left Adobe and wasn't focusing exclusively on Rich Internet Application. So he chose _ James Ward, which I think is. You know, good job, James.
Did he actually create a new account or did he just rename existing account?
He renamed it. He renamed it.
Okay.
So, but it's still, you don't lose your followers, but you still lose, you know, that long tail of presentations that you and I have all done.
Yeah.
And all of our slides. I wonder how that works. If I then go to my old, if I change my name and I go to my old handle, will I get redirected? I don't know if Twitter honors that or what, but.
I have no idea. What would you want to be then? It would be hard to shake what you got so far.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't even know what I would want to be, but it's just kind of interesting to think like, what would I do? Would that shake off the spam? Like every now and then, on Twitter, I get a lot of just troll accounts, spam accounts that are just leeching on your bots.
I see. Yeah, probably not. They'll find you, I think. Yeah.
if Twitter knows, then they know.
Yeah. So I've been because I do have Satanism in many places, but recently I've been finding out like, oh no, somebody took my handle already. Like Telegram, like somebody else has Satanism apparently. I don't know who, but you know, Fortnite. I don't know if you play that game, but you know, there are some games that just have Satanism. Reddit and other things, like some people actually got that nickname already. So a little sad. I'm a little sad.
Sorry, buddy.
So I'm Satanism too in some cases.
So. Oh, that's so weird. See, this is why now that like my friends had a kid recently, and I told them, look, this kid has just been born, but you should go out and register every domain you can.
Yeah.
You know, like do it now, you know, get the Facebook page, get the Twitter page, get the IRC handle, get the email, get the website, get all of it, you know, because that kid's going to appreciate it in, you know, 10 years when she's digital or maybe even earlier with today's kids, you know.
That is so true. Yeah.
Oh, well, okay, my friend. So that's where they're going to find you on the internet. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. I'm sorry to have kept you from dinner, but,
no worries. It's too early.
And you're in New York. Like I said, you can get food anywhere. So that's thanks for that. And we'll see you next time.
All right. Hey, thanks for this podcast. And I really appreciate your time as well.
Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers. See you next time.
A Buddhaful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where my DMs are, of course, wide open. Do you have any guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Please reach out to me at buddhafulpodcast at BOOTIFULPODCAST on Twitter. There, of course, my DMs are also wide open. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from a Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast. If you like the show, please give it a positive review on iTunes or on whatever channel that you use to consume the podcast. Thanks.